1, 2, 3, 4.
My name is Berta Marquez. Wait, what would you like me to say?
Berta and I have been friends for about 7 years, and I always knew her family came to the U.S. from Guatemala as political refugees. But what I didn't know was by the time she was just a few months old, Berta had made it on to the Guatemalan government's hit list. Welcome to Utopia, an audio documentary on the lives of two refugee families living in Utah. During the next hour, we'll map their journeys and answer questions like what compelled these people to leave their countries in the first place. In the case of Berta's family, they weren't just fleeing a country, but a company. We'll have her story and more after this news. Welcome back to Utopia, a documentary on the lives of two refugee families living here in Utah. As mentioned before the break, Berta's family came here from Guatemala fleeing both a government and a company. But as a kid growing up in California, Berta didn't know any of that. That would change eventually, when knowing what happened to her family would become the most important question to her. But back then, she was young. All she knew was she was happy.
So we came to Santa Ana, and it was like its own little Latino country. I didn't see my first white girl until we were 3 years into living here in the United States, in Santa Ana. And I remember thinking, why does she have yellow hair and blue eyes? Like, I didn't even know the word for blonde, you know? All the kids that I was going to school with were all Spanish-speaking, trying to learn English. We spoke very good Spanglish, you know?
Can you give me an example?
Yeah, like, no me pushes, or no chiris.
But even back then, there were signs that things weren't quite right.
I just remember when I start having memories, just having bouts of terror, absolute terror. And I had consistently dreams where our family was being chased and we needed to get to safety and I needed to get them to safety. And sometimes I couldn't. And this was when I was 4 years old, you know, 3 years old, five. So I was fairly young.
Though Berta didn't know it at the time, she was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And she had no idea why. The older she got, the worse it became. But it was her father who struggled the most.
He inhabited his own world, which was in the garage where he would repair refrigerators. And when he would show up, it was largely for criticism or rebuke. Quite often it involved yelling, you know. We had grass to mow, and it was my turn. It was my job to mow it, and I went to the backyard, and there was these mounds of dirt in the middle of different parts of the grass. And so I went into the house, and I was like, Mom, what's the deal? Like, I was going to mow the lawn, but there's little mounds of dirt everywhere. And she was like, Tu papá está teniendo una guerra carnal con los topos. Your father is having a carnal war with the gophers.
The more Berta's dad retreated, the more it was up to her, as the oldest of seven kids, to step in and help her mom Estella, who was working two jobs and going to school part-time. Meanwhile, the older Berta got, the more she wanted to understand what had happened to her father, and why her running dreams wouldn't stop.
Every now and then, there would be a whispered thing or a passing comment by one of my aunts, where they would mention something like, oh yeah, what happened in Guatemala, or what happened with your dad, or when your dad did X, Y, or Z, but it didn't necessarily sink in. I think the first moment when I became aware that something fairly serious had happened that could help to explain our family dynamic was when I was at one of my aunt's houses, and on her refrigerator, she had a magnet holding a newspaper clipping, and it was my dad, my mom, and I, And she was like, yeah, this is from when your dad was helping in Guatemala.
Sometimes Berta would come across old family photos, black and white pictures of her younger father with people Berta didn't recognize.
And so I asked my dad, and he would give me explanations like, oh, this was the ambassador to Sweden that I was meeting with. But he didn't necessarily provide context or background. Up to that point, I don't think that he'd ever had a very extensive conversation with anyone about what had happened.
Berta's father wasn't ready to talk about it, and she wasn't ready to push. By the time Berta turned 17, she couldn't be around her father anymore. So she left home, wandering from place to place, never really putting down roots.
You know, our family stopped running, like physically, we finally stayed in one place. But when I turned 17, when I graduated from high school, I wasn't done running, both from the hardships of our family life, but also just from all of the, I knew how to run, put it that way.
At 21, she ended up in Utah, where she enrolled in Brigham Young University. A few years later, her mom got into BYU too, and her family joined her in the Valley. With all of them living there, Berta decided it was finally time to figure out what happened to her parents in Guatemala. For a school project, she rented a camera and asked her dad if she could interview him.
And so I asked my father, Dad, I want to find out. I want to know what happened. I want it to be documented. I want to know what you went through. And for some reason, he agreed to give me a series of interviews. And that having that camera there, it was like almost this mediator that made it safe for him to speak of the things that he'd never spoken of.
After the break, Berta finds out what happened to her father so many years ago. Stay with us. Welcome back to Utopia. When we left off, Berta's father, Israel, had agreed to share his story. For those who are just joining us, Berta and her father had had a difficult relationship for as long as either one could remember. And while Berta knew it had something to do with her family's decision to leave their home country of Guatemala, she didn't know much else. That was about to change.
Mi nombre es Israel Márquez. Nací en el año 1949.
Israel is in his 60s now. His shoulder is a little hunched, his hair a little gray. When he came in for his interview, he brought with him a few pages of notes. And you can hear at the beginning and later during difficult parts of our conversation, his hands tightening around them. The story he told begins in 1951. This was the year a man by the name of Jacobo Arbenz became president of Guatemala. Arbenz saw the massive divide between the country's rich and poor and believed he had a solution. His plan? Distribute the country's land more equally across all members of society. The plan was incredibly popular, except, as you might have guessed, with everyone slated to lose property. This group included the U.S.-based United Fruit Company, a.k.a. Chiquita. Arbenz would never see his reforms through. In 1954, the CIA helped to replace him with a military dictatorship that would last for decades. Israel, who was five when Arbenz was overthrown, can still remember eating dinner under the table while planes flew overhead. At the time, the CIA justified the coup by accusing Arbenz of being a Soviet puppet. And some, including President Eisenhower himself, appear to have actually believed it. It was the Cold War, after all. But it's also worth noting that some of the coup's biggest supporters were or had been on the United Fruit Company's payroll. 30 years of repression followed, as well as the death and disappearances of some 100 to 200,000 Guatemalans. Those who survived went to work earning a minimum wage of 52 cents a day, Israel said. And with labor unions now illegal, companies were left to operate with little to no oversight. say a worker was injured on the job, there was nothing to stop an employer from firing him or her. Say that person got sick, same story. The Coca-Cola bottling plant where Israel worked was among the most notorious employers. The plant was owned and operated by a Texan attorney named John Trotter. According to Israel, when one of his employees tried to start a union, the guy turned up dead. I looked into this, and while I couldn't find a reference to this specific death, I also couldn't find anyone who questioned that under Trotter, numerous employees disappeared, never to be seen again. I think it says a lot about the kind of conditions the workers faced at the plant, and the few alternatives they had, when even after this, a group then decided to form a coalition, a sort of temporary committee, which they then brought to the court. And the court agreed they had done nothing wrong and could not be fired for it. Trotter was desperate. First, he tried bribing the coalition members with tickets to the U.S. When that didn't work, he hired three lieutenants from a Guatemalan military base. The group included an active member of Guatemala's secret anti-communist army, a paramilitary death squad unit.
Pero la decisión porque yo me metí fue por todo eso que yo veía muchas injusticias, pero también yo había crecido en una iglesia evangélica, pero cuando tenía...
Watching all this, Israel was torn. On one hand, he was doing well at the plant. His knack with the machines had earned him a seat in the daily manager's meetings and a lot more than 52 cents a day. The man, who didn't own his own pair of shoes until he was 11, was suddenly capable of buying a house. But he also knew not all his colleagues were as lucky. The decision wore on him, day and night, until finally he couldn't take it. He needed help.
He is a convert to the LDS Church, and he went to his bishop and said, I'm feeling like I should do something. And the bishop said, well, fast and pray about it, and if you feel like it's right, then you should do it. You should follow your conscience. And he did, and he just felt that. And he says he felt himself being propped up by something external to himself. There were other LDS ecclesiastical leaders that got involved, stake presidents and bishops. Was them practicing their faith, basically, and their view of how you live Mormonism.
How would you describe that view?
The closest thing is, I would say, liberation theology Mormonism, meaning a view of the gospel in which the disenfranchised and the marginalized have a priority, and where it's necessary to advocate for and with people who are being oppressed.
So, Estella, what did you think when he said that this was his decision?
When he made the decision, we were about to get married.
Oh!
And it was scary, though. It was very scary. I never imagined. I didn't know. I was very naive. I was 20 years old. But now I decided to start writing my journals and typing my journals, and I was rereading the story. And those were very incredibly difficult years for us. I just remember the terror, the horror of waiting to hear bad news about him, because his life was constantly in danger. And when he will not come back on time, I just remember fearing the worst.
Israel spent a total of 5 years fighting for workers' rights while living in Guatemala. But he said, it felt more like 20. Twice he went to jail. Then there was the tear gas, the military dogs that took up patrol of the plant, and the constant sleep deprivation as he and the others held their own in lengthy legal and press battles. The activists had spies in the courts, the military, and government offices, all of whom helped them stay, if not one step ahead, then at least alongside Trotter and his people. According to Israel, the help didn't stop there. To this day, he's convinced inspiration was on their side, explaining he didn't know how, but sometimes he just knew that the plant was up to something and what he needed to do to fight back. There was this one thing Israel refused to do, and that was to take up arms. When he eventually did start carrying a gun, he kept it loaded with a single bullet should he ever be taken captive. Even when guerrillas offered to kidnap Trotter, Israel said no, a decision that to this day he does not regret. The Houston lawyer would never know his life was spared by the traitorous coalition member.
Eventually, he was asked to become Secretary General of the National Workers' Coalition, and the two men before him in that position had both been assassinated. My father describes how he would try to change his appearance because he was in the press. They would do press conferences or, you know, journals were covering what he was doing. So he tried to grow out his beard and covered his widow's peak and so on. And he talks about eventually how when it got really bad, he would change, you know, vehicles very and use public transportation so he was untraceable. But what led up to that kind of hypervigilance and fear, he was driving this Jeep and he pulled up into the driveway. He started pulling up and immediately, like just gunfire started going off and surrounding the vehicle.
So I ran to the door because he was smacking the door like bam. So I ran to the door, and in Guatemala, you don't just open the door at those hours. You have a little door in the door that you open to see who is there. So I opened the door, and I saw him full of blood, and I was like really shocked. And he's just said, let me get in. So he got in. We closed the door. We had a metallic door. I just remember that. And then he said, somebody shot me.
Israel felt back then the same thing he feels now, and that is that his survival that night was, in fact, a miracle. That said, neither he nor Estella were ready to test their luck any more than they had to. Local church leaders formed a kind of underground railroad for the couple, who went into hiding separately. In the meantime, Israel and Estella rented out their house to a newlywed couple government forces would later mistake for them. The husband was saying goodbye on the doorstep of the house before a day of work when the assassin struck, killing the man and leaving the woman blind. But no matter how often Israel changed his location or his appearance, it didn't matter. Someone always recognized him. The decision to leave Guatemala came down to this. Israel realized he would be of a lot more help, both for the cause and his family, if he wasn't spending so much time just trying not to die.
What ended up happening is they decided to hold a press conference at the Venezuelan embassy in Guatemala, because if there's a press presence, it's less likely that something would happen. And both our family was in one vehicle that was being driven, and another gentleman, also an activist, also in danger, were basically going into the embassy.
And while Guatemalan authorities would never rush the building, something they would later do to hopeful escapees holding up in the Spanish embassy, that didn't stop them from circling the building and taunting them. This lasted for months, until finally the government cut them a deal. You can leave, but you can never come back. So they left and made their way to Costa Rica. By this point, Israel and his friends had caught the attention of more than just the Guatemalan government. Their fight had transformed into a rallying cry for unions and labor activists around the world. Once in Costa Rica, Israel became like a touring rock star, traveling to some 40 countries to meet with sympathizers ranging from presidents and prime ministers to religious leaders. Of all these stops, none was written about more than the one that took place at Coca-Cola's 1979 annual shareholder meeting in Delaware.
And there was this group of nuns that had a little holding interest. They had an investment. And they had invited my dad to come with them, basically, and speak if they could get him in. And so after the gentleman finished giving his statement of, like, the state of the corporation financially, the profits, and so on, this little nun raises her hand and says, you know, we would like to say something. They're sitting in the front. You don't say no to a little group of nuns, right? And so they had my father stand up, and he starts giving this, he starts just saying it like it is, you know, and he said, in Guatemala, Coca-Cola equals blood.
The movement finally began to see some success. A boycott hopscotched its way around the globe, picking up powerful allies in places like the UK, France, Japan, Nicaragua, Scandinavia, and New Zealand. Their demands were this: remove the independent contractors that ran Coca-Cola's bottling plants, men like John Trotter, and replace them with Coca-Cola employees who answered directly to headquarters. Doing so, boycotters argued, would give the company more control should an owner start killing or tear gassing its employees, for example. The boycott lasted 4 years before Coca-Cola finally caved. Even today, when Israel talks about this moment, he becomes emotional.
Y entonces, cuando él anunció eso, inmediatamente la Coca-Cola le quitó la franquicia a los empresarios de Guatemala. Y pusieron ellos sus propios gerentes, y desde entonces ya no hubo ningún problema ahí.
But just like in Guatemala, the more success the movement experienced, the more Israel's life was in danger.
The Costa Rican government was working in conjunction with the Guatemalan government and eventually decided to extradite my father back to Guatemala, where he would either be assassinated, disappeared, killed. And so they jailed him in Costa Rica. My mom says that we went to visit him. By that time, my brother had been born in Costa Rica, and, you know, that we were trying to reach him through the bars and crying.
As news of the extradition spread, so did protests against it, especially in Europe, where activists petitioned Costa Rica's government to not give in to Guatemala's. It worked.
And so whenever I'm up against what seem like insurmountable odds, I have to remember that I have a father because a small group of people decided that it would be unjust to extradite him to be killed.
Israel was spared. But many of those he worked alongside with back in Guatemala weren't. Both he and Estela watched as friends were assassinated, as Guatemala's dictatorship dug in its heels against those trying to bring about change.
I called him on the phone once, and I was like, Dad, I want to know who these men were who died, like the men that died that were your friends, you know? Who are these bishops and state presidents and these professionals, these lawyers, these journalists that were killed? I want to know their names. I want the world to know who they were. I want them to be remembered. And he said, maybe when I'm dying, I'll tell you. Once I began to become acquainted with sort of the valley of the shadow through which he had lived, I realized that as children, we grow up only knowing if our needs are being met or if they're not being met, without necessarily understanding or being acquainted with the fact that our parents have a lifetime of inhibitions and sorrows and their own humanity.
Do you see your dad in you?
Absolutely. Myself and my brother and I, my brother who is just after me, all three of us, you know, have generalized anxiety, clinical depression, and PTSD.
Years later, the healing process would reach a kind of conclusion during an especially difficult time for Berta and her wife, Kathy.
And he called, you know, and he left a message on my voicemail. I think if it wasn't voicemail, he wouldn't have said it. But he said, with everything that is happening, I want to talk to you and I want to say that I love you. You know, and I keep that voicemail. You know, I'm keeping that voicemail.
After the break, we'll take a step back and examine the wider journey most refugees take when entering the United States. Welcome back. You're listening to Utopia, a documentary on the lives of two refugee families living in Utah. So far in the show, we've heard the story of the Marquez family, who arrived from Guatemala years ago after the father, Israel, was the target of several assassination attempts by the Guatemalan government. Next up, let's take a minute to trace the journey of a refugee from his or her conflict-ridden homeland to Utah. Our guide, Gerald Brown. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, test.
Okay, I'm Gerald Brown with the Refugee Services Office of the Department of Workforce Services in Utah.
Gerald says that worldwide there are 20 million people living in refugee camps. That is the equivalent of 7 Utahs, all living outside their home country in some kind of makeshift community. And that's the key here. A person can only be labeled a refugee if he or she is living abroad. Say you were driven from your home, but not your home country, you're a displaced person. And here is where things go from bad to worse. Because all told, there are 40 million people in this category throughout the world, living in conditions much like refugees, the only exception being their tents were pitched inside their country's borders. But say you do find yourself in a neighboring country, there's still one step before you can officially claim the title of refugee. And that is that someone from the UN's refugee agency has to meet with you and declare you one. The process is labor-intensive and far from easy for anyone involved.
So once they get the camps established, then they start interviewing people, right? And I've done it for them, and it's unbelievable, the conditions. So you're trying to get all this information on people, and you've got people crying, and it's cold, and it's raining, and people are smoking, and kids are running all over. And, you know, often you can hear gunfire in the distance, you know, heavy artillery, but you're trying to, okay, so how did you come? Like that.
Not only that, but the questions themselves are often heavy. This is because leaving one's homeland is not, on its own, enough to be granted refugee status. In order to make the cut, a person has to be fleeing persecution of some kind. So Gerald says, when you see TV footage of people flooding into Greece or Turkey, for the most part you're seeing migrants. Some may be refugees, but many aren't, not officially at least, not until they pass that interview. But say they do, now what? Option A. The conflict back home resolves itself and you can go back. This is, of course, the best case scenario. But as any Palestinian born and raised in a refugee camp in Lebanon or the West Bank will tell you, it's not a very common one. Option B. You resettle in a nearby country, one that speaks your language and harbors similar customs. No doubt the second best option, but there's a catch. Many countries lack any kind of pathway to citizenship for refugees, as well as any way for incoming refugees to find work legally. The result? Millions are left in limbo in UN-funded camps throughout the world, in some cases for generations. Option C, third country resettlement. This is what it's called when a refugee settles in a place like the US, where there is both a pathway to citizenship and a way for him or her to work legally. All told, less than 1% of refugees fall into this category, half of whom end up in the US, the other half in places like Australia, Japan, Canada, and Scandinavia. Okay, so that's the refugee process globally. Now let's zoom into the US, and from there, Utah. Here's everything someone with refugee status has to go through before settling in the US. First, they have to be chosen. Each year, the State Department selects some 70,000 people based on who already has family living in the US, and how dire a person's situation is. People considered to be more vulnerable are given priority. So say you make the cut. You're in, right? Well, not exactly. You'll have to do another interview, this time with the State Department. And then comes the security vetting process. Fingerprints and photographs are taken and scanned against all kinds of government databases. And just like in the days of Ellis Island, incomers are screened for any potential health risks they may pose. All told, the process takes on average an entire year.
And then all 70,000 are to one of 9 national nonprofit organizations, all headquartered on the East Coast, all of which have affiliate offices scattered around the U.S.
Oh, so it's almost like they have subcontractors.
That's right.
There are lots of organizations here in Utah that help refugees once they arrive, but only two actually responsible for getting them here. They are the International Rescue Committee and Catholic Community Services. So to review, any refugee who arrives in Utah has gone through the UN to the State Department to national nonprofit. But just because a refugee has made it to the United States doesn't mean the work is over. There's still the process of integration, something that the Department of Workforce Services, where Gerald works, specializes in.
And I think when we fail on integration is when we have problems. I don't think it's terrorists sneaking in through the refugee program. I think it's when we fail to make people feel like they're a part of the community.
And are we failing?
I think that we do in some cases, yeah. I think that we've got youth that are not connected. We've got to do a better job of that. But it's not just refugees. I mean, my heart is with the refugees, but it's very clear that it's everybody in the community, whether they're a refugee or not, whether it's some white guy. If that kid, that white guy, feels alienated, white guys do dangerous stuff all the time in the U.S.
Moral of the story, yes. There is a carefully crafted system that every refugee must go through before arriving in Utah. But as Gerald points out, that doesn't mean every refugee who comes is at the same point in processing the trauma they've experienced to get here.
Everyone is different, right? The Burmese, golly, they went into Thailand. They've been in Thailand in camps for 20 years. You know, the young adults that you see here were probably born in the camp, right? The Iraqis weren't in camps long. They came from very violent situations, and they came pretty quickly to the U.S. Many of the Iraqis that are resettled here help U.S. forces. They had, you know, they bought the idea that, you know, the U.S. was going to come make a democracy that was going to make it better. They are jaded because that didn't happen. They've seen their relatives in car bombs, you know, blown to smithereens. And they come quickly, so they haven't had the time to decompress. So I think there's more anger in Iraqis in the beginning than some other groups.
That's understandable.
Isn't it? Yeah. I mean, and once you think of it that way, then it's not so easy to say, oh, they're just playing, they're just gaming us, right?
Coming up, we'll hear from a refugee family who escaped the bombed-out streets of Baghdad to downtown Salt Lake. Welcome back to Utopia. In this final segment of this audio documentary, we'll trace the journey of an Iraqi family as told through the eyes of a 25-year-old Baghdad native.
So my name is Islam. I am from Iraq, was born and raised there.
Islam was 11 years old when U.S.-led forces invaded. Prior to the war, she said, life was good.
We went to school. You know, some days we were up until 2 a.m. Sometimes we don't lock our doors, we don't lock our cars.
Was there ever any sense that you were living under this oppressive regime?
No, not at all. Not at all. It was because of certain, you know, political disagreements. My father was captured and, you know, in a prison, you know, tortured, blah, blah, blah. But that was... that was specific, you know. People knew what they weren't supposed to say or do, so they don't get into that.
So there's almost a level of defensiveness regarding that period, regarding
yes,
Saddam. And do you feel like some of that comes from the outcomes of
yes,
the invasion?
Definitely. But if you speak to my father and other Iraqis who were in fear or who were captured by the Saddam regime, they would tell you, yes, we were in fear, but we were in fear of one thing. Right now, we don't know what we're fear of. We're just in fear and in terror all the time.
My name is Abdul Karim. I am veterinary doctor in Iraq.
Islam's father was in his third year of college when the police showed up at his house looking for him. Word had gotten out that he had spoken critically of the government, and they were here to take him away. As an American hearing this, I felt like I was listening to some kind of dystopian nightmare. But Abdul Karim, he had nothing but nice things to say about his captors. Did the police just knock on your door? How did they come and find you?
No, they respect. They respect.
What do you mean they respect?
Door. They nicked the door and said, we need me and my brother, two brothers, they take all.
The way Abdul Karim described it at first, it was like a group of guys had invited him to some sort of retreat where they fed him three times a day and lectured him on how to be a good citizen. It wasn't until I asked him directly if they had beat him that he said yes. Then he added, they had tied his hands and hung him from them, twice. He was in jail for a total of 3 months and then released back to his family, who knew all along exactly where he was. After the invasion, people just started disappearing. Forever. I think it's important to point out here that Saddam wasn't just responsible for jailing and torturing loudmouthed 20-somethings who didn't know when to stop. The man oversaw the murder of hundreds of thousands of his own people, many of them Shiites or Kurds, and started two wars that together left more than 1 million, and possibly twice that number, dead. But so long as we're doing the numbers, here's another. 650,000. That's the number of Iraqis the medical journal The Lancet estimated died of war-related causes within the first 3 years of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. A more conservative number is that of 500,000 for the period between 2003 and 2011, as put forth in 2013 in PLOS Medicine. What do you remember about
I remember that? Seeing explosions happening in the sky, you know, it would be at night, and all of a sudden it turned really bright, like it's the morning. And I remember my younger sister would see that and she'd say, "Oh my gosh, fireworks." And so these are the things that I remember. I also remember shootings. I saw one time someone get shot next to my house. He was getting bread. I don't think it was clear who did it, but it's a product of the war. That was not something that would have happened before the war. I saw, you know, body parts in the streets.
The sound you're listening to comes from a video of American soldiers during the early days of the invasion of Iraq. Islam was just 11 at the time, but she can still remember clearly what it was like after coalition forces arrived.
I remember them flirting with little girls very well, and I was just like, no.
What do you mean flirting? What were they
so
doing?
They would, you know, what's your name? You want my number? They would touch them and, you know.
Touch them how?
Like they would try to, I remember they would, you have such pretty hair, and they would hold their hair and hug them and, you want to take a picture of me? And I was just like, these little girls, what are you, you know, you're not a celebrity.
A power vacuum formed out of the chaos. And as always the case, there were those ready to fill it. Formed in 2003 with the goal of expelling the Americans and establishing a Shiite government, the Mahdi Army quickly became the second most powerful force in Iraq after coalition forces. But not all the members of the Mahdi Army were exactly volunteers. Included in those they tried to force to join their cause, Abdul Karim.
They wanted him to join, and he said no. So they began making calls, we'll take your daughter, her name is that, and she goes to that school. And it was a nightmare for my dad.
When I talked to Abdul Karim about it, he pointed out that it wasn't just the Mahdi army taking people captive and holding them for ransom. When the Americans came in, they dissolved Iraq's army and police force, and the rule of law went with them.
If you now imagine Salt Lake without police and army, and the jail is open, the people from the jail, they're jumping to the rich family, they kidnap the for money. This is what happened to Iraq.
This was the moment it all became too much. The family had tolerated the bombs, the shootouts in the street, the never-ending night, and the constant threat of death every time one of them left their house. But this was different. This time there was a direct target on their backs, on Islam's back. First, the family went to northern Iraq where things were quieter. After a few months, though, the family decided to leave the country altogether and head for Syria, where they would spend the next 2 years. While there, they applied to the UN as refugees. Then they were given the option of moving to the US, which, thanks to a recommendation by an American friend based in Iraq, was arranged without almost any hassle. Next came the decision of which state to go to, a decision that was left to Abdul Karim.
And they told him, Utah is a good state for big families, for seeking education. It's not fast-paced, but it's very safe, and it's family-friendly. So my dad was like, okay, we're going there.
And do you feel like it has lived up to that reputation?
Yes, it did. Yep. The Mormons are very similar to Muslims in kind of the family traditions of having big families, making sure they eat meals together. So that's kind of similar modesty.
What was it like the day you got off the plane and you were like, we are living...
Oh, miserable.
...in the U.S.
The first week was miserable. Because we were facing this idea that this is the very country that invaded us. This is, you know, we're walking around these people. The Americans we saw before are soldiers. And so that's the picture we had, soldiers, you know, aggressive. But the more we interacted, I remember very well this lady, she walked up to us and she's like, oh, you guys, where are you from? Hi, you know, just out of nowhere. Hi, where are you from? And my dad was like, oh, we're from Iraq. We just got here. And she said, oh, are you guys okay? How was it there? And so we kind of, that was our first time to speak up and be like, oh, it's bad. You know, we miss our families, but it's very not safe over there. We lost so-and-so. And this lady began to cry. And so when she began to cry, we were like, okay, maybe calm down.
The war changed Islam in fundamental ways, ways that 8 years later have yet to show any signs of budging.
There's one thing that I will always remember is that before the invasion, I was a lot happier, a lot more optimistic, a lot more going after challenges and going for adventures. This is no longer the case, and it's because I have a PTSD. I have flashbacks of, you know, what happened during the war. I'd say I'm in constant fear.
Fear of what?
Just fear of whatever that can go wrong. Anything, especially losing family members. And it literally disables you at times from going after your dreams and doing the things that you were thinking that you would be able to do.
Given just how much the invasion took from Islam and her family, I was relieved to hear that almost unanimously Utahns have been supportive, expressing interest and willingness to help, be it providing furniture or food. But I wanted to know, is there something Utahns can do better?
What happens is that people are nice, so they're friendly, hi, how are you, and stuff. but they're afraid of asking questions of what the media has been portraying. So very rare do people ask us, and when they ask us, they're very hesitant. Because
what do you mean ask you?
Why are you guys here? Why do you guys wear a headscarf? Are you guys refugees?
So you do want those questions.
We do want these questions because we feel like it'll clarify the image for them and it'll help them get past stereotypes.
So say it's someone in Walmart who's shopping the produce aisle next to you, and they come up and they say, you don't look like you're necessarily from...
We welcome that.
Okay.
We welcome that.
Maybe there are people out there who would be less than enthusiastic about a stranger approaching them. But I can say that after talking to Islam, I decided to give it a try. I was in line at the post office on State Street in Murray when a younger man and an elderly woman speaking Arabic got in line behind me. Immediately, my mind started spitting out all the reasons I shouldn't turn around. They're talking, I shouldn't interrupt. What do I say, anyways? But Islam had seemed so confident, so encouraging. So I turned and asked them where they were from. Their answer? Iraq. Less than 2 minutes later, they had invited me over for dinner. Just as I did with Islam, I wanted to know, what was it like for Abdul Karim to live in the country that was the reason he and his family became refugees in the first place? His response personally meant a lot to me.
Gandhi, you know Gandhi? He said, if we punish the people, how we stop? So must I pray? I said, God, please. I protect all America from any things. Like, this, my regime teach me. If I am really Muslim, before I sleep, I forgive any person.
Well, as an American, thank you.
Thank you.
Ross Chambliss edited this documentary. Jesse Ellis helped engineer it. Miss Spelt wrote and produced the theme music. Alex Vincent wrote and produced all the other music in this show. Brooke Parker and Austin Gee helped translate hours of tape. Steve Peterson and Joey Ferguson helped fact check. Daydream Crisanto and Janelle and Chris Patton were crucial soundboards throughout this process. And last but not least, KCPW was an invaluable partner in making this happen. A supersized thank you to each and every one of you. I'm Tamara Kimsley. Thank you for listening.